And welcome to Pros Before Hoes, the podcast where we talk about what we're thinking, drinking, and reading. What are you drinking this week, please, Camilla?
I don't know, Elle. I don't know what I'm drinking this week. It is... So I went into Sainsbury's and I literally just picked something off the shelf of tinnies. Something that I didn't know what it was. It's called Topo Chico.
It looks like a beer, but it's not a beer.
It looks like a beer. And I don't think it's a beer, but we will find out. It's called Topo Chico Hard Seltzer. Topo Chico. Sparkling water with alcohol. Oh, that sounds rank. I definitely should have read that. Let's see what it tastes like.
I didn't know you could get these in this country. I hear on other podcasts, people talk about having alcoholic seltzer in America, in the USA.
It does sound like the name Topo Chico does sound like a bastardization of, like, something from Mexico that Americans have done.
What is it? Wait, how many calories is it? Is that its appeal? 96.
Maybe that's meant to be the appeal.
Yeah, that you can drink, but...
Yeah, this is tangy lemon lime flavour, which is going to go great with the toothpaste in my mouth because I just brushed my teeth.
I told her not to.
Well, you're the one that has to sit next to me.
Yeah, so but I live with you, so the damage is done.
Love the implication there. I am clean, guys, and I smell nice.
Most of the time.
Rude. All right, let's get that.
That was a good one.
Wasn't that refreshing? Bearing in mind, it's just
I'm so intrigued by this.
It's just turned midday on a Sunday. I'm cracking into an alcoholic seltzer with my freshly brushed teeth. All right, here we go.
Oh, the face didn't bode well.
Do you know what? We'll come back to it at the end of the episode because my toothpaste will slowly... go away, and then I'll get a sense of what it really tastes like.
Can you save the final last bit?
I will for you.
Yeah, because I want to try. Can you hear that? That's the soft tread of Camilla as she runs to get the door. I wonder what she's bought this time.
For context, I've just run off to go answer the door because we had a delivery, and... given that I'm like a bull in a china shop, I've literally broken everything made of porcelain in this flat. So I finally ordered some porcelain glue. And I thought it was a small tube. Anyway, it's about the size of my forearm.
But that's good because...
because I will break more things.
More things will get broken.
Anyway, a nice little diversion from our alcoholic content. So yeah, we'll let's circle back to how Topo Chico tastes. But... yeah, it's not... it's hard to tell with the toothpaste.
Does it taste alcoholic?
Not really.
Okay.
Which is probably good, given that it's so early on a Sunday.
4.7%. Interesting. This could be a real game changer.
This will be great. I'll do my yoga straight after. What are you drinking this week, sweet angel?
I've made myself a really rather perfect-looking baby Guinness.
You have, and for clarification for readers, would you like to say what a baby Guinness is? Because when somebody first used that word with me, or that name with me, I thought they had just poured Guinness into a tiny, tiny glass. That's not what it is, apparently.
No, it is Kahlua with Baileys on the top, and the way you have to tilt the glass, you put the Kahlua in, and then you tilt the glass, and then you gradually pour the Baileys in, and then it looks like...
a baby Guinness.
Yeah. So I brushed my teeth over an hour ago, but I still think this is going to impact this. So bear with me. I'm also really trying not to spill it on Camilla's carpet.
Oh, you guys should have seen how she just did that shot. Very sexy.
Thanks. Oh, it's such a shame that the rest of the world can't be seeing me doing shots.
Such a shame this is an audio medium.
Well, no, you've got to leave things to the imagination. Maybe one day, coming to the Instagram, there will be a video of me doing a shot, but probably not if I have my way.
How did that go down?
Yeah, they're so nice.
They are really nice, actually.
They're so easy to drink, it's dangerous. I was like, I could have it now because, like, coffee liqueur, coffee.
I was going to say.
The morning, yeah.
It's just like a morning coffee, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, a little bit of a kick, but you have one and then you immediately want another.
They are tasty, but Baileys is nice. Baileys is something I've been recently turned on to, which I think shows that I am hurtling towards middle age.
I would never have it just like on its own, but yeah, I say 2020 was the year that Baileys like shed its face to me properly, and I appreciated it. mainly just putting it with coffee, essentially. That means that I like it.
We did do that in one episode, didn't we, last season? We did do Bailey's coffee on a Sunday morning as well.
Hey! We should... do you have cold brew? Did I see that?
I do.
There are loads of nice cocktails you can do with Kahlua and cold brew and Bailey and other things. So we should like branch out and try something.
We'll do that. Next episode we'll do a fancy cocktail for you guys. It's been a while since we've done something other than blind pick something up from the Sainsbury's shelf. But do you know what? It's good because maybe next time you're in Sainsbury's you'll see Topo Chico.
I'm intrigued by that. If I like that, I'll be happy.
What have you been up to the last week? As we know, there's so much going on right now. Truly, my personal freedom has never been so unlimited.
What have I been not? I've been doing a lot of walking.
You have been doing a lot of walking. You did something like 36,000 steps. Another thing that shows that we're hurtling towards middle age, step counting.
Well, there's nothing else. It's like an achievement, isn't it? I mean, I always do a lot of walking, but this weekend is really... I'm pushing the boat out. Because I'm going to Hyde Park again today.
Are you?
Yeah.
Crikey.
You know it. So I've been enjoying walking.
That's good. That's legal. Just about.
Actually, the amount of steps I do, I'm probably walking too far. Boris is going to be like, hey, stay close to home.
Actually, he did cycle 7 miles?
Yeah, but he's very much do as I say, not as I do, isn't he? And then something I like this week, even though you didn't give it to me this week, but I'm mentioning it this week.
Oh my God, I did it. What did I do?
When you got me my little personalised notebook, which says Elle's impromptu recipes on it. Because, in fact, you explain.
Well, Elle is the talented cook of the two of us, but she never uses recipes. I think you once cooked from one of my Ottolenghi books and you were so angry that he didn't include a bechamel sauce that you are now determined to never cook from another cookbook
again. Well, you agreed though, didn't you, that mushroom lasagna needed a bechamel.
I don't think it needed it, but I'm never going to say that a creamy cheese sauce has made anything worse.
She said that it needed it at the time.
So you are the more talented cook, but you never use recipes and you always, I mean, I often just like scrape in on your dinners because they're so much better than mine. And I mean, to be fair, it was a nice gesture, but it was for purely selfish reasons in that I just want you to write down your recipes so I can emulate them, because you always serve like these amazing like curries and stews. And I'm like, oh my God, how did you make that? And you're like, oh my God, I don't even know. And like birds gather around you and your little apron floats up in the wind. And
I sound like such a wanker. The problem is, though, have you seen how I've written the recipes in?
Oh, I've not actually looked. Anyway, I bought Elle a surprise recipe notebook for her to write her recipes down in.
Elle's impromptu recipes.
Yes.
So I just doodle it in as I go along. But the problem is, there aren't any specific measurements because that's not how I cook. But it tells you, like... I think it could still be helpful.
Do you know what? I think that's fine. We're publishing a book at Ebury, the New York Times. It's a New York Times cookbook, and it's entirely devoted to not having measurements in it.
But that's how to actually cook.
Which sounds very appealing to me, because I have to admit, even though I do often use recipes because I'm not as imaginative in the kitchen as you are, or as intuitive about it, I do often not follow like tablespoons, largely because I can't be bothered to get the tablespoon measure out of the drawer. And I'm like, yeah, this looks about right.
But it's good.
Maybe that's why my food is never that good.
But no, that's not true. But also, I think when you've been cooking a while, so I don't measure, but I know in my head how much of it's about ratios, essentially.
Yeah,
so I don't use actual measurements, but that's because in my head I know how much of each like roundabout I need.
Yeah.
So an intuitive cookbook like that, I think, is really good because it teaches people how to actually cook.
Yeah.
And be confident cooking, because then they'll be like, oh yeah, that was that, that was that. So I'm fully behind that.
No, I think it sounds like a good idea. I'm excited. I will definitely be sneaking a copy. One of the pros of working at a publisher. Free books. Like, I don't have enough books in the house to the point where I'm using them to hold things up.
Yeah, we don't have
a bookshelf.
No, when we first moved in, we wanted one, but
there isn't really anywhere in the living room to put it.
No, it's awkward. I've got a little one in my room, but otherwise books are just
haphazardly strewn everywhere in our flat.
Place.
Like your
coffee table.
There's like a basket in the living room where if you lift up a blanket, there's just like a pile of books underneath it.
Are there books under there?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I've been hiding books under there. It's like an addiction. I have been, and this will explain why I've been randomly shouting French words at you all week, which I'm sure is fun given that I don't really speak French. I've been watching Call My Agent, which comes highly recommended from many people on Twitter and from my boss. So yeah.
My boss also recommended
it. I thought
it
I would start it, and I thought it would be funnier. It's funny in a very subtle way, but that's probably because it's French. Although I have to say, the show is really, really good, but I have a problem with French. Not with the French, although I think they know what they're doing.
But here we go.
I have a problem with French because it's the sort of language that you just want to speak.
Yes.
And you'll be familiar with this, Mrs. Emerald League.
Oh my gosh.
Knight in Shining Armor.
Oh my gosh, no, actually.
Duolingo queen.
I have to update you because I've moved on leaps and bounds. I am now, oh my god, it's not going to load.
While you find that, I'll just say, the problem with French is that you really want to speak it. It's the sort of language where they have words that just perfectly capture a mood.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to go all in. You can't be like, oh, you know, it's got that certain je ne sais quoi. You've got to be like, yeah, like je ne sais quoi. And then you just sound like a bit of an asshole. But then when the French do it, they sound brilliant.
But so you can do it just like casually.
Yeah, but
you can't.
I can't. So it feels like a personal affront because I either go too far one way or too far the other. And it's uncomfortable for everyone either way. But I have been randomly yelling French words at Elle. And literally every time she walks into a room, I think I just yelled, Je m'appelle Camilla, at you the other day. So
salut!
Salut!
Yeah, so I'm in Pearl League.
Pearl League? Oh my god.
I'm ninth in Pearl League at the moment. And in 12 hours and 4 minutes and 20 seconds, if I stay in the top 10, I get promoted to Obsidian.
Obsidian?
Oh, yeah. I don't know when they're going to run out of, like, precious metals.
What I want is for Duolingo to make the league sound less and less impressive. I want you to get down to, like, essentials.
Cardboard.
Yeah, like you're in the cardboard league. You're an everyday essential. You can get
maybe
around.
Maybe that's what will happen.
That, to me, cardboard level, screams conversational French.
Bubble wrap.
Bubble wrap league. That's when you can have a little bit of fun with the language. It's jaunty, you're comfortable.
There's a flirting
thing.
So when I get to that, be prepared, guys. Not just me doing a shot sexy, but me talking sexy.
That being said, when I said parlez-vous français to you, and I said, what would you reply? You just looked at me nervously and went, no.
Because I get very, oh, what's the word? I just don't back myself. I'm good. Me and Duo. Oh, we're riffing. We're having a great time.
You and that little green owl.
I mean, that makes it sound weird.
I mean, maybe it is. But yeah, so I've been watching Call My Agent. I really, really recommend it. It's good TV. And we watched It's a Sin, didn't we?
We finished that. We did watch It's a Sin.
Finally, I feel like we were a bit behind on that one.
I don't think it was that we were behind. I think it's that we just watched it in a more old-fashioned way. Okay, we didn't watch it when it was on Channel 4 at 9 p.m.
We watched it with
day.
A pipe.
But we didn't just binge it, which I feel like loads of people did.
Yeah, and I feel like that was a good move because it is quite heavy-hitting. I couldn't really relate to the main character, but I think, like,
oh, I wonder why.
I don't mean relate, obviously. I mean, I couldn't get on board with him as, like,
oh, yeah, because he's a dick.
Somebody that I was hugely invested in, but all the other characters I loved. And I didn't know anything really about the AIDS crisis, to be honest. I think it's not, for maybe it's just my school, but it was really not something that
it's not spoken about enough.
And I think it reminded me why the arts are so important, because they really are the mirror to which we hold up to society, because the government won't do it for itself.
Mm-hmm.
So support the arts. Small segue here, really leaning in.
No, it was very good. My one annoyance, but I just think it would have benefited from being longer, because it was 5 episodes, wasn't it? And I feel like it was so good, but almost felt a little rushed in the last episode.
Yeah, it escalated very quickly,
which I think was deliberate, but also I feel like, I don't know, I just think it could have maybe fulfilled more of its potential if it had been longer. And actually, this is quite interesting, my friend who works in TV, originally it was pitched to be 8 episodes.
Interesting. I do think there's a huge thing now with, like, what is the best length the TV shows to be, because obviously in America stuff goes on for like 34 episodes in a season.
I can't get on with that.
In England we're kind of leaning more towards the 5 episodes, and I'm like, are the English just trying to self-ration?
I do think 5 is quite short though. Usually it's 6, right? 6 to 8.
Between 6 and 8 feels like a comfortable length to me for a series. And then, especially a one-off.
Yeah. And then UK shows usually only have like 3 seasons, like max, which I like. When shows go on for like 8-9 series, I'm just a bit like, surely it can't be the same show. It's not the same show. It can't be, because it's just moved on, and I just, yeah.
No, it is. It's true. Sometimes you do watch the last season, you're like, we could have wrapped this up a little bit sooner. I'm gonna step in on your territory and say that I've been listening to some music this week.
Oh my gosh, I've also got a recommendation coming up.
Because I've also been doing a bit more walking, been trying to up my walks to 2 a day.
Yes, it's the way forward.
I'm slowly trying to increase it, and I'm sure you're doing the same, to where I'm just walking all day and not sitting down at any point. that'll be my March challenge. Just don't stop moving like a shark.
You can play S Club 7.
Just slowly go insane listening to Don't Stop Moving, walking around Clapham for the 400th time in a day.
I'm now imagining a shark swimming to Don't Stop Moving by S Club.
That song was made for sharks.
Yeah, heard it.
Was that song written by a shark? So I've been listening to some songs. I've been adding to my funky playlist and my smooth playlist. And yes, I do organise my Spotify playlist like your grandfather talks about his record collection. My Spotify playlists are actually incredibly chaotic. I've got ones with like one song on it. One playlist which has one song on it, and it's Hall & Oates, You Make My Dreams Come True.
Well, that's not a playlist. That's just a prison for a song.
I would argue that is a playlist, because that song is an entire mood. And some days I just listen to that song on repeat. So,
but that's what I mean. You don't need the playlist.
But yeah, I wanted to give it, you know, its due diligence. I wanted to give it its own stage.
I like that you viewed it as a stage and I viewed it as a prison. It's a solitary confinement for a song.
Honestly, my playlists on Spotify are like word association games. I'm like listening to a song and I'm like, this makes me think of the word powder puff. I'm gonna make a Spotify playlist, and then it just means...
I have that though. Yeah. All my playlist names are very intuitive.
Yeah, it's like a mood. Mm. I've got one called Big Walk, and you know what I mean when I say
Big
Walk.
Yeah, exactly. Has it got Big God by Florence and the Machine on it? Because it should.
Yes.
Yeah.
That kind of vibe. Mm-hmm. Kiss with a Fist by also Florence and the Machine. but I have been specifically listening to a lot of funky and jazzy songs recently, and I can really recommend Get High by Chet Faker, and basically anything by Chet Faker. I think he's coming out with a lot of new music at the moment, but Get High is very, mm-hmm. very funky. And then on a more jazzy vibe,
this is like your auntie. This is Carol.
Carol's back.
I don't know if people know, Carol is Camilla's alter ego when she's a bit drunk, and also just when she's being like an auntie. Kind, it's hard to explain. Carry on.
I'll leave it to your imaginations, listeners. And then the other song I've been listening to a lot is American Cliché by Finneas. And what I really like about Finneas is that none of his songs sound the same, but they're all good. Like, there is no thread to his songs. Like, they all are completely different genres, but he's incredibly talented, so I can really, really recommend that. It's very chaotic. But yeah, that song is all about a man waiting for he's heartbroken and he's waiting for a woman in Paris.
Oh.
So he's an American cliche.
The best kind.
The best kind, the only kind. what have you been listening to?
I've been listening to a song called Get to Know Me by, I'm going to say Reeve, but it's all caps, R-E-A-V-E. And no one would call their band R-E-A-V-E, right?
Yeah.
Reeve.
Reeve.
But no. It's got no accents on it.
Oh. Then Reeve?
Yeah. Nah. But it's so addictive and just so good. I've been working out to it. I've been doing yoga to it.
Mm.
I've been walking to it. I've been dancing to it. I've been living to it. but yeah, it's a really great song. And we'll add all of these songs to our infamous playlist.
Well, I don't actually think we've mentioned it on the podcast, because so we have made a Pros Before Hoes playlist for you guys, because one person asked.
Three people asked.
Don't let anybody tell you that we don't have fans. because they are clawing down the door. Three people asked for us to make a playlist for the music recommendations that mostly Elle suggests on this podcast, and I sometimes dip in with. So that is on Spotify, and it's literally just called Pros Before Hoes, isn't it?
Pros Before Hoes, what we're listening to.
We're listening to. Wow. In keeping with the theme. Yeah. Love it.
Thank you for that recognition.
And I also wanted to... This kind of toes the line between should it be in the book section or should it be in this section.
Oh, she's messing with the format, guys.
I'm messing with the format. But it is a poetry collection by Inua Elams called The Actual, and the cover is great.
Ah, yes, I have seen this.
Yeah, so it's I think it's meant to be called The Actual Fuck, but fuck is written all over the cover and crossed out, so the only words that haven't been crossed out are The Actual.
See what they're doing there.
But he's written loads of poems, and a lot of these poems are... about more serious stuff. They're all very good. I can really recommend it. But I thought I'd slip it into this section because it is just one poem that I wanted to read. It's called Fuck Limp Handshakes.
Mm.
You should do like this. Your four fingers should lift and hold whose hand you grip. You're saying, I got you. You're got. As your thumb completes the lock. You push down as if leaving your thumbprint. As if gifting its tiny terrain of hills and valleys. Yourself's singular geography. Your soul's surface code. For this occasion of meeting, you wait until you feel a response. Then lift your eyes to find its accompanying gaze. You hold. You squeeze tighter. Again, you give of your land, give of your fibre. You're saying, remember me, as I will you. All through childhood, you practice before a mirror, diligently imagining a truce in civil war, a father reconciling an estranged son, two media moguls merging their worlds. You bring such weight to first handshakes, only to reach out now, and what grasps you back is weak as a cooked noodle, limp as a warm slug, frail as a stale celery. What the actual fuck?
Frail as a stale celery.
And oh. I think it's great when, in a single poetry collection, somebody can make you think and make you laugh. And that's definitely what this one does. But that is a favourite one that I saw circulating on Twitter a while ago, and I had to buy the whole book because it just...
I'm haunted by stale celery.
Stale celery is quite rank. Limp as a warm slug. But hey, that's good writing if it makes you feel immediately grossed out.
Yeah. I can't get the imagery out of my head.
This week, for judging a book by its cover, Elle has given me Howard's End by E.M. Forster.
A classic!
I love that your judging a book by its cover recommendations just consistently out me as somebody who is not particularly good at reading the classics. I also love that I clearly wrote... So I ended up looking at this about 4 days ago, 5 days ago. And I don't know what kind of mood I was in when I did this, but my reply is, as per usual, quite chaotic.
Here we go.
So the cover is... It's one of the Penguin kind of classics. So it's got like a pattern of objects on it. It's got umbrellas... in an umbrella stand, some closed umbrellas and open umbrellas, and some artfully placed polka dots. And then, of course, the little penguin. Little penguin on the front. It's a nice cover. Feels like a classic.
Mm.
Makes me feel classy.
Nice blue tones. Duck egg blue, some grey.
So I actually have no idea what this is about, which is probably quite telling. and what I've done is I've said, look, there are umbrellas on the cover. So it's clearly set in the UK.
Because this is so funny because, yeah, okay.
Because it doesn't rain anywhere else. So, and also something about the umbrellas feels like London. They're those really long, pointy ones that you just, I feel like you just don't see those anywhere else. Those are London umbrellas. Okay, they've got a sense of authority about them, but also a sense of being quite apologetic. So I was thinking umbrellas, there's a penguin on the cover. I know the penguin is related to the publishing house, but still, he's right there on the cover. So I'm thinking... Is this Mary Poppins' gritty next gig? In a one-up, one-down maisonette in the bad part of London. I can't say what... The bad part of London. I can't really say what that part would have been because it's all been gentrified now anyway. But yeah, that's my guess. Penguins, umbrellas, I'm thinking Mary Poppins.
What happens? Do things happen?
So I think it's not children this time. I think it's a quarrelling couple.
Okay.
Called like Betty and Bob or something.
Okay.
And the neighbours have called in because they keep having rows.
It's quite dark.
No. It's just, you know, they're just going
the
to...
The neighbours are calling they can overhear rows.
Okay, well, they're quite loud. It's not dark. They're just having fights. They're going through a turbulent time in their marriage. Mary Poppins comes in and she fixes it. Betty and Bob, happy as Larry. That's my honest guess. I'm feeling confident about this one.
Yeah.
I really think I've nailed it.
Okay. Well, let's draw on the positives.
Thoughts and prayers to any of my ex-English teachers, by the way.
So, London is an important location.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Nailed it.
Yeah. So, moving on. Yeah, so this classic is all to do with class, families, and the intersections of how those kind of ideas work together in, and I think it's late Victorian, early Edwardian, but I am really rather bad
like with that. Time.
So yeah, it's the intersection of different families and individuals along the lines of class, ideology in different ways, and circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
There's two families.
Okay, I'm hearing family.
Yeah.
I'm hearing class. I definitely picked up on all of this.
I mean, I'm not going to say that there aren't arguments in it. There's two families, the intellectual, cultured, and idealistic Schlegels.
Are they both alike in dignity?
And then the materialistic and sort of commerce-orientated Wilcoxes. So they're both upper class.
Okay.
Then classic Forster, because it's all about relationships and like how people are connected. It's quite hard to explain. I'm going to do my best without giving things away. So Helen is one of the Schlegel daughters, has a brief but failed romance with Paul Wilcox. That's okay. Sort of at the start, that sort of sets off the connection between the families, as okay. It were. Then we've got Leonard Bast, or Bast, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Take a pick. Who is separate from these families. He's an impoverished insurance clerk. So he's like an outsider, but yeah. Linked to them all. A bit like Nick in Gatsby.
Okay.
That kind of vibe. Helen, at a classical music concert, I think it's for Beethoven, takes Leonard's, they're sat next to each other, and she takes his umbrella by mistake.
Okay.
And goes home with it. And then Leonard has to go and retrieve his umbrella.
Okay.
From that family. And that's sort of how they connect.
Okay.
Then the Wilcoxes move from their estate in the country, Howards End, to opposite the Schlegels in London. And everyone's quite surprised by that. So it's the sort of how all these families, even though Leonard's kind of on his own, how they all interact. So Helen and Paul are gallivanting off in other parts of the world. So Margaret is the head of the family, who Emma Thompson plays in the film.
Oh, good. There's a film. I'll watch that.
She's the eldest and head of the family, and she befriends Mrs. Wilcox.
Okay.
Sort of further cementing how they're connected. I'm not going to go on because then it will ruin the story.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of intellectualism sort of as a luxury of time is explored because the Schlegels have the financial security and thus the time to give thoughts to such matter and read and engage with sort of arts and culture.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously the lower classes, all their time and energy is going into putting food on the table and surviving.
Yeah.
So Leonard is intellectually, I'm not sure if you can hear that, guys, but it sounds like there's a ghost just trying to communicate with us.
It's the ghost of E.M. Forster come to get me for my interpretation of his front cover.
So Leonard, yeah, is quite aspirational in his sense of he reads a lot and he wants to engage with these intellectual ideas.
Yeah.
But he's also very practically orientated in order to sort of get by and live. And so they're sort of at odds with each other.
Yeah.
And when it's set is important because that was a time where society was changing and lifestyles and technology were sort of very much altering how people thought people should act and classes and all that kind of jazz.
Yeah.
So the umbrella is a sort of marker of the class divide. The Schlegels don't even, the fact that she's taken his umbrella, completely inconsequential. It's just an umbrella, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Whereas to him, he needs to get that umbrella back because that's like quite pivotal because if it's raining in London, he will get wet. If he gets wet, he will get ill. Then you, do you know what I mean? It's the how
chain of events
exactly have a much bigger impact if you're not so well off than if it's, oh, it's just an umbrella, it doesn't even matter. And then losing the umbrella affords Leonard a sort of window, almost like an invitation into that lifestyle of the upper class, because he has to go and collect it.
Yeah.
And in collecting it from them, he obviously meets them and has a conversation with them. And because of that, it also represents a philosophical barrier between practical and intellectual. Mm-hmm. Not that they are at odds with each other, but that given the sort of class structures, that they kind of are in reality of people's lives. Because in other circumstances, he would have had the time to dedicate to such thought and the umbrella wouldn't have been so important.
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting, this idea of like how the arts kind of relate to class. And it's something that I've been thinking about a lot because of the way that the arts have been treated with such incredible disdain over the course mm-hmm. of the pandemic. But this idea that the arts are just for the upper class, but the majority of the arts are populated by struggling artists
mm-hmm.
who don't make very much money. Mm-hmm. And it's this really weird, yeah, the way in which kind of lower classes often find themselves performing for the upper classes, and then the upper class is like, well, we can just get rid of that and we'll bring it back when we want it. Not tuning into the fact that it's actually people's livelihood. So I think that kind of intersection of class and leisure time.
And it's so true that the majority of people in the arts aren't rolling in it.
Mm.
But then if you get to a certain level of success, then suddenly you're propelled into this other lifestyle. So yeah, I agree. I think the arts industry is a really interesting sort of lens to look at. Not necessarily class per se, but financial security is really interesting.
There aren't very many industries where if you're not at the very top of your game, you're considered to be a failure.
Exactly, yeah.
Whereas if you're an artist who just works job to... If you're an artist or an actor or a singer who just works job to job, you're kind of seen as like you've not made it. Whereas people do those things because they love to do those things. And obviously, I'm sure a lot of them aspire to fame, but a lot of them just want to do the thing that they love every day.
I think it's the idea for people not like directly engaged with it.
Yeah.
The idea of the struggling artist, it is very dichotomized. It's either you're a struggling artist or you're successful.
Yeah.
Whereas I do actually think in that world, it's like any other job to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Where people are it's true. It's funny. It's interesting to look at. There's a quote about the umbrella, which I'll read, which this is Leonard. This is him thinking to himself when he's going to collect the umbrella. And Margaret, one of the sisters, is talking he's sort of getting this window into, wow, this is what they talk about,
this is how the other half lives.
Yeah. Yes, the umbrella was the real trouble. There had always been something to worry him ever since he could remember, always something that distracted him in the pursuit of beauty, for he did pursue beauty, and therefore Margaret's speeches did flutter away from him like birds. So the reality is that his poverty dictates the prevalence of the physical over the conceptual in his life. And like I said before, given other circumstances, he could have been just like the Schlegels.
Yeah.
But they don't need to worry about staying dry.
Yeah.
Bringing
it
back to the umbrella.
Yeah.
Interspersed with the class sort of ideas, the sort of real heart of the book is this idea of only connect and the sort of importance of interpersonal human relationships
mm-hmm.
and to listen to sort of what makes us human and our inner passions and emotions. And only connect is the epigraph. And you can sort of see it as an invitation to connect with all people, regardless of class and social conventions. So the emphasising of the human connection. And then against a backdrop of all this, Forster was sort of scared of, I think, what he coined imaginative poverty that he felt was going on in society in the face of all this new technology and how things were advancing really quickly.
Yeah.
And so emphasising the human connection to oneself and others is not something that should be pushed aside. We need to remember that, which he's so ahead of his time, because the things he's thinking about are things we all talk about now, like social media and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, the idea of really focusing on what unites us. It's very humanist, I guess, in a lot of ways. A line that sort of sums up that thinking in the book
mm-hmm.
is, man is an odd, sad creature as yet, intent on pilfering the earth and heedless of the growths within himself. He cannot be bored about psychology. He leaves it to the specialist, which is if he should leave his dinner to be eaten by a steam engine. He cannot be bothered to digest his own soul. It's just so ahead of his time.
Yeah.
And it's really, really interesting, I think, reading it now. Obviously, the way it's written is like classic Forster. So you have to get into it.
Yeah. Not a light read.
No, it's not a light read, but once you've got to grips with the style and how that's just how people spoke back then, once you're in that.
I think when it comes down to it, the at its very core, the things that we struggle with as humans and even things that pertain to kind of class struggles are issues that have been around for hundreds of years. They just present themselves according to the context of the time.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that, you know, we can always learn something from reading literature that touches on these issues, even if it's 200 years ago, because the fact of the human condition prevails.
Yeah, and the thing is, this isn't... I think this was published in 1910, but again, not so great with dates. So it's not that long ago, but because of what's happened in recent history, like, a lot's happened in between then and there. Yeah. So it feels long ago, but then also feels very current. Yes, everyone, it's one of those books that everyone should just read.
I'm busy. No, it does sound interesting. It does sound up my street, actually. So I'll probably grab that one off you.
You should. But also, don't feel too much pressure to read too many of the classics too soon, because I do think it's quite a nice feature of when I do judging a book by its cover, I can go back and we can discuss all these kind of books.
I thought you were going to give me like a really patronising lecture there, like, you know, don't read the classics too quickly, pace yourself.
Oh my god!
They're quite difficult.
Wow. I would never.
We have got a real treat this week. So we were very kindly sent a proof of the book The Shadow in the Glass by J.J. A. Harwood, which publishes, I think, on the 18th of March.
My sister's birthday. Mm. And my dad's.
So Harper Voyager very kindly sent us some advanced proofs of the book. Ella's had a little read of it. And we've actually got a short clip of the author herself introducing the book. So take it away, J.J. A. Harwood.
Hey. My name is J.J. A. Harwood, and I am the author of The Shadow in the Glass. This is my debut novel. It's coming out on the 18th of March this year, and it is a dark and gothic retelling of Cinderella, which I have set in Victorian London. It's a story of what happens when Eleanor, a young woman forced to work as a servant for the family that adopted her, meets her fairy godmother, who grants her 7 wishes to do exactly as she pleases with. But there's a little bit of a sting in the tail with those wishes, and Eleanor soon has to ask herself if magic is really worth the price she'll have to pay. It's very dark, it's spooky, but I had a lot of fun writing it, and I can't wait to hear what you guys think.
Thanks, JJ. As JJ said, it's a sort of reimagining of Cinderella. But it's rather dark.
We love a grim fairy tale.
Was that a pun? Like, the Brothers Grimm?
Yeah.
Was it?
No.
Okay.
Definitely. I much prefer the Brothers Grimm, and also Hans Christian Andersen, who wrote all of the fairy tales that you like, but with much darker endings, originally before Disney made them nice.
Well, that's the thing. Fairy tales are dark.
Yeah.
And then Disney made them all saccharine. But yes, so this is a dark reimagining of Cinderella. And it's interesting. It really, again, looks at class. Like, class is really important, and circumstance and sort of...
Well, again, that's such a huge thing in so many fairy tales.
Yeah.
Like, basically, that's what every fairy tale is about.
Yeah. And then it also looks at trauma. And women's issues are sort of threaded.
Women's issues?
No, but they are. They're threaded.
Yeah.
The whole way through. And some, like, very explicit.
What kind of? What
like,
kinds of?
Pregnancy and abortion and ideas around that. Some are alluded to, like lesbianism and same-sex relationships and queerness.
Yeah. Although I suppose we should say that pregnancy is not purely a woman's issue. Anybody who can give birth, within the context the main character is a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's framed and emphasised by the time period.
Yeah.
But obviously relevant now.
And yeah, of course.
Interesting in how it makes you think.
What's the writing style like? Like, what's the...
So I think it's, like, super easy to read. Super, super easy to digest. I feel like it's young adult.
Okay.
Some of the best books.
Oh god,
a young adult and children's books. So
I love dipping into a bit of John Green every now and then.
Exactly. But yeah, so it deals with quite some dark things.
Yeah.
Class is interesting because Eleanor, who's Cinderella, as it were.
Cinderella.
Hey, she's working class, but her mum works for the lady of the house.
Okay.
Then her mum dies and the lady of the house sort of adopts her and becomes the guardian.
Yeah.
But then when she dies, Eleanor is sort of thrust downstairs and becomes a maid. And the man of the house, let's just say, he's not great.
Right, I think we can make some inferences there.
Exactly. But because of this sort of interesting, like, Eleanor's had this lifestyle.
Yeah.
She's almost a bit of a snob.
Okay.
In that she thinks she's better than her circumstances. And it's interesting because it's unfair. She's been treated awfully. And it is unfair. But that's also, the other side of that is that she, I don't particularly like Eleanor. She's tough. And what she, and she's like resilient and impressive, but I don't actually like her because what repeatedly comes through is she's really quite entitled, which is interesting because it's not that, it's not that she just wants to have a good life and not have to worry about food and like not be worked to the bone and have like an awful boss, because obviously everyone,
Of course,
it's not like she's wishing for just basic sort of human rights, as it were. She wants, she wants propelled way more than that. She thinks she often talks about being a princess. She often talks about how she just thinks that she should be in really nice dresses and going to all these balls and like marry a prince and things like that. And so that's interesting because it, it, she's not just like, you don't just think, oh, this is so unfair and she's such a great person, I really like her. It's more complicated than that.
I think it raises an interest. I mean, we've said before that we don't mind an unlikable main character. Yeah. I don't think it necessarily takes away from a book at all, but I think it's interesting the way that it sounds like this kind of raises the question of what are we entitled to and what kind of freedoms and luxuries are we entitled to. And I think everybody should aspire to get, as you know, the best possible scenario that they can, but it's interesting to hear the way that she seems to approach it.
Well, maybe it's just how I obviously, like, the way I'm interpreting it. Everyone interprets a book via themselves, so obviously that's having an impact.
But if you don't interpret it like we do, then you are wrong.
Yeah, it's just interesting because she really cares about the people she cares about.
Yeah,
she wants to look after her own, as it were.
Yeah,
I guess it's just quite, like, conservative, like, with a small c. Her approach is quite conservative. It's not about, like, everyone being okay. She's not, like, this pillar of, she's not an angel by any means.
Okay.
And that's really looked at as well with the wishes and her fairy godmother, as it were, who's a dark, sort of menacing presence.
Yeah.
And how she uses the wishes and her idea of like responsibility for her actions and the consequences of her actions and how that's looked at, I really liked, because it's not, it's not made explicit. You just pick up throughout as her, as your idea of her as a character builds, that becomes more and more important. With regards to sort of the personal politics and the relationships, what she wants is paramount. Okay. So it's not that she comes across like a horrible person.
But she's a protagonist in every sense of the word.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's interesting.
So there's love in it as well. I don't want to go into who that is because I think it will...
No.
...ruin it somewhat.
We don't give endings away. No spoilers.
No spoilers. One line in reference to her sort of love interest is, she'd hacked his life apart and put the pieces back together in a way that suited her. And I think that really sums up her approach.
I kind of like that. As in, I like that description of it.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds like she is very much like, her character is quite definitive, which I think is...
Yeah, it's, but it's so interesting because she's perceived by many as this, as a kind of angelic, not angelic, oh yeah, kind of angelic presence. And then even to herself, I think she thinks she's like a great, she always talks about being a good person and how she couldn't possibly do that because she's got to think about other people. Yet the reality of what she does, it's almost, in lots of instances, it's, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. I could never do that. No, I must do that. That's the best thing to do. Oh, I must look after people, blah, 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 blah. But then she does things that fuck people over. And more her awareness of that that's going to happen is there, yet she still does it.
Yeah. I like that. She sounds complex. Not as in I'm saying I laud her laud her behaviour. I'm saying I like that in a female protagonist where they kind of play with that idea of, like, you know, obviously women so often in literature, especially if you go back a little bit, are put up on this pedestal.
And exactly.
I like this thought of somebody living up, thinking they're living up to that pedestal, being put on that pedestal, but actually they're not.
Yeah.
I think that's a level of complexity that,
it's
quite hard to get across.
She's a good character in that regard, for sure.
I love it when books talk about fairy tales. It reminded me when we were kind of talking about this, and that it was a kind of fairy tale retelling of a book, which is kind of
here we go. What?
Oh, this book is so weird and I loved it so much. It's The Pisces by Melissa Broder. Is it the Pisces or the Pisces?
Pisces.
One of those weird words that I don't think I've ever said. As in, like,
the horoscope.
Yeah,
Pisces.
Okay, so the book is called The Pisces by Melissa Broder, and I'll quickly read the blurb, but it is kind of not a retelling of The Little Mermaid at all.
But... I was going to say, but obviously fish. Obviously.
Fish. Well, fish in romance. So the kind of blurb is, Lucy has been writing her dissertation for 9 years when she and her boyfriend have a dramatic breakup. After she hits rock bottom, her sister in Los Angeles insists that Lucy dogs it for the summer. Staying in a gorgeous house on Venice Beach, Lucy can find little relief from her anxiety. Not in the Greek chorus of women in her love addiction therapy group, not in her frequent Tinder excursions, nor even in Dominic, the dog's easy affection. Everything changes when she becomes entranced by an eerily attractive swimmer while sitting alone on the beach rocks one night. But when Lucy learns the truth about his identity, their relationship, and Lucy's understanding of what love should look like, take a very unexpected turn. So this is about Lucy falling in love with a merman, whose tail conveniently starts below his penis. It's and I cannot stress enough how clear that is made in the book. I think The Guardian really coined it when they described this book. They said it's a bracing satire of love in the age of consumerism, where a woman finds emotional and sexual satisfaction with a mythical sea creature. It's sort of like a Dirty Little Mermaid, but like role reversed. But it is technically literary fiction, and it's written incredibly well. Yeah, I mean, the way that the main character kind of leans into the material to find joy, so she kind of really buys into this whole fairy tale idea of love and kind of looks for it in all the wrong places and all the kind of materialistic places. What I liked was that the book really feels like a comment on kind of consumerism and ideals,
mm-hmm.
and the materialistic side of love. And I thought it explored really well this idea that even dating has become a commodity. When we use Tinder, when we use Hinge, we're literally, like, shopping for a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that came across really well in it. But kind of, yeah, the way that she leans into that material to kind of find that joy and fill the void, it works really well within a kind of fantastical and immaterial fantasy element. Because it's almost Angela Carter-esque in the way that she writes. Like, okay. Her writing is very, very good and very immersive. She tackles this idea of, like, fantasy versus reality incredibly well. In that at no point are you disbelieving, despite the fact that she's literally having an affair with a merman. You're like, you know what? Fair.
Happens every time I go to Cornwall.
Yeah. I should go to Cornwall.
I told you.
Yeah, no wonder you keep raving about it. Yeah, so it's almost like Angela Carter-esque in the way that it degrades fairy tales and makes them really gritty. But it really brings to light the kind of disillusionment of modern romance. The fact that she can only find happiness with a mythical creature. And this idea that perfect love is mythical, it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what you're looking for, you will be constantly disappointed. And again, the main character is incredibly apathetic. Like, you do not particularly like her.
Mm-hmm.
She is a hot mess.
Okay.
But yeah, it's really, really well written. It's really entertaining. And yeah, I just really kind of liked the stark contrast of disappointment in her human encounters versus this kind of perfect, complete merman. It's very compelling. It's kind of creepy. It's weird. And it's very good. I can recommend it. It's also got a great cover. It's basically a woman holding a fish.
Oh, it's like a old Hollywood kind of movie.
It's like
poster.
An old Hollywood poster of like a...
with a fish.
Of a beautiful woman cradling a giant fish. It's awesome. Kind of when we were talking about this, it really reminded me of that in that way that kind of writers can play with fairy tales in the modern day.
Yeah, that sounds...
kind of era.
That sounds interesting.
I recommend it if you like weird books.
Yeah, well, that I do. Is it... how long is it?
It's not that long. It's probably 250 pages.
Yeah, an afternoon.
Do you know what? Despite the fact that the content is odd and the characters are odd. And,
it sounds like it would be super easy
God.
Get through.
Like, absolute filth. Almost like chick-lit levels of easy to read.
It's so weird. I can't get my head around. I can. I have such a clear image in my head. But also,
I spent a lot of time thinking about the anatomy of it.
Oh, I don't want to think about that.
Just purely out of fascination. Mind you, she goes into a lot of detail, so you don't have to imagine that hard. But
now I'm thinking about stale celery.
But again, I really like it when kind of female protagonists explore their kind of sexual desire, and like for a writer to present it in such a strange way, mm-hmm. I think is quite unusual. Like, the freedom with her sexuality is so far that she's literally having sex with a fish.
But that doesn't doesn't seem. The way you've described it doesn't seem weird, like a big deal. But is
the book, it's not presented as that weird.
But imagine if you did meet a merman and you like, I can.
I just don't think my first thought would be sex.
Well, no, but like if you got on with them and then you like, do you know what I mean? I can understand.
For the record, L can understand why you might have sex with a mermaid.
Yes. You know what? Yes, I can. And I'm not ashamed of that. I think if it was a really handsome, charming, you got on really well, and they were a merman, I feel like dealing with the fact that they were a merman would come later.
I think it would probably be the first thing I would notice.
No, obviously the first thing you notice, but as you got to know them, if you built a connection with them.
Oh yeah, but I was going to say in the same way, like it is with anybody. Once you get over their tail, really, everything else is easy. I can see that you've got another fairy tale book
yes, with you here. Just four children. Like, actually four children.
Moving swiftly from borderline bestiality.
But
onto...
that's the thing about fairy tales, is they engage with dark subject matter, real life. It's all proper stuff, but they're for kids. And that's why they're for kids, so that kids have an understanding of the world and moral ideas.
And then Disney ruined it.
Yeah.
Apart from in The Lion King, that was dark.
But The Lion King isn't a fairy tale.
Oh, yeah, because animals can talk.
Yeah, but it's not a fairy tale. Fairy tale is a genre. And just because you have talking animals does not make a fairy tale. Let us be clear. This is Gender Swapped Fairy Tales by, and I'm saying by, Carrie Fransman and Jonathan Plackett. But, I mean, it is by them.
Okay.
Their names are on the front. Carrie did the illustrations and Jonathan created the computer program, or algorithm, I should say, that swapped all the genders in fairy books, which is a sort of archetype classic collection.
Yeah, yeah.
Edited by Andrew Lang of Fairy Tales.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he made an algorithm that would swap all the misters to miss and all the his to hers. And
that's so cool.
Yeah. Really, really cool.
Oh, I love
cool.
stuff like that.
So the stories are the exact same. I think they changed, like, dress to suit and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but in
yeah.
terms of the content, it's the exact same.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just gender swapped, as it were.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
And I've only read one of them. I read Cinder, or The Little Glass Slipper, because I thought it fitted in well with...
We love a theme. We love
with
a theme.
Shadow in the Glass.
Yeah.
It's got all the ones we know and love. So Little Red Riding Hood, but the wolf is a woman.
Oh.
And Red Riding Hood is a boy.
Mm.
How to Tell a True Prince, which is Princess and the Pea.
Oh, okay.
But the prince, obviously.
The Prince and the Pea.
Jacqueline and the Beanstalk.
Ah, Jacqueline. See what I mean about French? God damn
it. Yeah, but see how I said it? Just like... Also, that's just Jacqueline. I just said Jacqueline. I'm doing a lot of French at the moment, guys. But also, interesting things like Gretel and Hansel. Like, you don't often think that it's always the boy's name that goes first.
Oh.
And they've also done that on the front, where Carrie's name is before Jonathan's, which I picked up on that. I appreciated that. But yeah, the illustrations are really nice. I think she did them with watercolours and different...
Oh, they're beautiful. It looks like, even though it's a book on fairy tales, it's a nice book to have.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful book.
Yeah, and it's just really interesting, because you read them, and you obviously they're stories you know. But actually, at the start, when I was reading Cinder, I was like, kept getting confused in my head, because you know the story.
Yeah.
So it's talking about the
does it force you to kind of... What kind of stuff does it force you to reckon with, or is it
Well, no, so it was talking about the stepbrothers. Yeah. Obviously, you know the stepsisters.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I kept getting really confused, being like, wait, who is who? Because you're, really, unpinning what you know already about the fairy tales. And so I'm really looking forward to reading the others, because it's not... Basically, you're doing all the work, but you don't really know you're doing it. It's just really interesting.
I think that's interesting, because there's been obviously a lot of discussion in recent years about the kind of stereotypes that fairy tales enforce, and the fact that we do just so mindlessly hand them on to children and not really think about the impact, so...
So that they've got a really nice author's note as well, which I would recommend reading before you. Because often when I read books, I don't really like reading the author's note before I read the book.
Yeah. I'm just impatient, so I never read it.
Sometimes I do, but more often than not, I read it afterwards.
Yeah.
But I would, in this regard, definitely read the author's note, because it creates a sort of nice bedrock to read the other stories on.
Yeah.
But yeah, the cover is really nice as well. It's
really gorgeous.
The take on Rapunzel.
Yeah, where it's got a beard.
He's got a beard.
What's your favourite fairy tale?
Oh, I really love fairy tales.
Quick answer, first thought.
Little Mermaid.
The Little Mermaid. I think mine's Rapunzel.
Yeah, Rapunzel is cool.
Maybe it's just because I've always struggled to grow my hair long. Mind you, Tangled. Fucking sick movie. Such a good
What's
film.
The other one? Princess and the Frog?
That yeah, the Princess and the Frog
is also
good.
Is that
one
set in New Orleans?
Yeah, it's set in New Orleans, yeah.
Is it actually, or is it, like, alluded to?
No, I think it definitely
is. Oh, it actually
is. The new one is. Obviously not the original one.
Yes! The Book of a Thousand Days. I can't remember that much, other than that it's really stayed with me, and there's a lady in a tower, and that's a good reimagining of a fairy tale vibe. I think it's of Rapunzel, but it might just be an amalgamation of lots of different ones.
Okay, that sounds interesting.
And that's by Shannon Hale.
To be honest, fairy tales, good thing to read right now. A little bit of escapism. Absolutely love it.
They're like escapism that is a mirror unto yourself and the world.
Coming back to that point, guys, the art, a mirror to which we hold up to society.
And fairy tales are a perfect example of that.
Tell me, Elle, what have you simply hated this week?
It's more a fear.
Is it the ransom notes again?
No, I would like to clarify to everyone, I am fine. No, it's just my fear of the heating bill.
Oh, I am sorry. I get cold so easily.
I'm so scared. But it's not a hate, because I want us to be warm.
It's difficult. It's a hard thing. It's like, I want to have more money. I also loathe to be cold.
I knew when we moved in, I was like, it's lower ground and ground in an old house.
Yeah.
With no, what's it called? Double glazing. Like, the heating is going to be a lot in winter. And now, yes, I am scared, but in my head, I'm like, it's nearly spring, and basically...
We've only had 2 months of real, like, cold.
Yeah.
So I have had the heating on in July before, so...
That is not happening this year. As soon as it hits I'll give you March. As soon as it hits April...
Okay, I thought you meant I was going to have to turn the heating off in March, and I was like, whoa, no, buddy.
I'll give you March, but then April...
But I'm a delicate flower.
April to September.
Okay.
It only goes on in the evening.
It's just my hands. If my hands get so cold.
Layers.
Then I can't use them.
Layers.
I don't want to have to wear 4 jumpers in my own house.
She says sitting in shorts.
I'm wearing little booty shorts. I'm in my house. I can wear what I want. I can be free. I'll walk around in my pants if I like it.
Okay. No, yes, you can. But not with the heating on. You have to have put adequate layers on in order for the heating to go on.
It's feeling a lot like a dictatorship right now.
Well, it's not, because the heating's always on, so I'm failing. I'm failing in my vision.
It is a constant. It's like the lights. I'm the person that turns the lights on.
It's also because I just am so, like, aware of energy and the world. And I'm just, like, not being used.
Yeah, I'm happy to watch the planet burn.
She doesn't mean that.
No, I don't mean that. I want to cuddle it up and cradle it and comfort it. But then it would get warmer, so that wouldn't work.
No, that wouldn't work.
I want to put it in a freezer. I want to put planet Earth in a big freezer.
But view it like this. This is how I view it. Turn the light off. Cradling the world. Yeah, I'm going to put it in terms that make sense to you.
You should work for the government. That's a brilliant slogan. Hug the planet. Put it in the freezer. Turn the light off.
No, but the freezer uses energy.
Oh. Just, do you know what? We could actually just put planet Earth in our basement in the winter. That's how cold it is.
No, my room.
Your room is actually colder, which is surprising given that my room's on the basement.
I think you have the warmth from the Earth.
Well, actually, the temperature plays into my dislike of the week.
Oh, there we go. It's a theme.
So, because the weather is... I think because it was so fiercely cold, we had a bit of an influx of spiders coming in. So that's my dislike of the week, is I've been finding false widow spiders in the flat. Found them in the bathroom, found...
Which is so interesting, because I've literally not seen a single one.
Well, I'm in the basement level.
But I have spiders in my room. I just don't mind, because I hate flies.
I just get the poisonous ones. You get the nice, friendly daddy
long legs. Maybe they are false widows. I just don't know what a false widow looks like.
So. Yeah, so I have quite a bad fear of spiders, which means I have to know everything about them. So I know exactly what a false widow spider looks like, and have developed many techniques for disposing of them from afar. But I keep finding them all over the flat, and the most exciting thing that I think happened in lockdown one was I got bitten by a spider.
This was actually wild.
This was wild. I got bitten by a spider in my sleep. I got bitten by, I'm pretty sure it was a false widow, had a really nasty, like, bite mark on my boob.
And I fully didn't appreciate how... Camilla, I'm not sure if you've noticed, is quite a dramatic character sometimes.
I'm not dramatic. I got bitten by a spider on my tit.
But when you first got bit, I was like, okay, thinking it was like...
Yeah.
Just like, okay.
No, I still have a scar.
And then she showed me the bite, and yeah.
I still have a scar from it. And that's how you know it was a male spider. Straight for the boob.
I genuinely was going to be like, do only the male ones bite?
You know what men are like.
Oh, God.
So yeah,
that's like a fairy tale. Oh my God, it could be a whole new fairy tale.
What am I going to get? Like
Spider-Man, but the fairy tale.
Just get like a radioactive boob. That'll be my superhero name. Super Boob. Anyway, that's my dislike, is that I keep finding these little fuckers all over the flat. And I swear to God, if they come for my left boob, I'm going to be mad.
But I'd rather have... Having a good amount of spiders... And I don't profess to know about these false widows. But it's good to have some spiders in your house, because you don't want flies in the summer.
Okay, flies don't bite me.
Yeah, but wouldn't you rather have no flies than, like, one or two spiders?
I have a scar. I am permanently marked.
Just put some bio oil on it.
I've been putting bio oil on it. It's been a year, almost.
It's not. It happened in May.
Okay, it's been, like, 9 months. Still. I could have grown a baby in that time, and I still have that scar.
That is true. But babies scar you for longer.
It's just no winning.
Like 18 years.
This drink is interesting, Topo Chico.
Topo Chico.
I think in the summer, it would be very refreshing.
Okay.
It's very light. My problem is I don't really like fizzy drinks.
That is a problem.
I don't really like...
Because isn't seltzer, that's its thing.
Well, it is literally defined as sparkling water with alcohol. I think in the summer, it would be refreshing, but that's part of the reason I don't drink beer. I'm not super keen on the taste, but also it makes me bubbly. So that would be my main qualm against Topo Chico. But otherwise, I don't know. Elle, why don't you try it and let me know what you think?
How is that alcoholic?
I know, right? It really doesn't taste alcoholic. It just tastes like flavoured sparkling water.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my goodness.
This summer.
I mean, this summer anyway. But I think it would be quite refreshing on a hot day.
No.
I almost said refreshing, which is horrific
thing. No, I'm really excited by this, but how is that alcoholic? You could just have that in the day.
Is that the same percentage as beer? Is beer?
4.7%. How is this 4.7%?
What percentage is beer?
Yeah.
4.7%.
Like, around then. Let's do some quick market research.
Oh my God, maybe I can drink this in the summer and it looks like beer, so people will think I'm cool and chill and I drink beer.
But do you actually like it?
Not that much.
4 to 6%, yeah, is beer. Wow. This has blown my mind. But it doesn't... But also, I like the taste of alcohol.
Well, we're going to have a lit summer with Topo Chico.
We really are.
This sounds like a sponsored advert for Topo Chico.
I mean, it can be. They want to send us some more. That's
get lit without knowing. So, Topo Chico, here we go. Summer 2K21.
Yeah, big, big fan of that.
Thank you for tuning in to the second episode of Season 2, S2E2. Thank you so much for tuning in, and your favourite literary aunties will be back in a couple of weeks. Let us know what you think of this episode, and if there's anything you guys want to see, we're all ears. We just want your ideas.
Talk to us.
Oh, that rhymed.
See ya.
Auf Wiedersehen.
If you've enjoyed listening to Pros Before Hoes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Otherwise, we'll have no idea.